Hello everyone and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
For the first time, I was more afraid to work at the Capitol than my entire deployment to Iraq.
Under attack by homegrown insurrectionists, police describe that fateful day as hearings into the January 6th Capitol invasion get underway. Former Republican governor and 9/11 commission chair Tom Kaine joins me. Then, democracy under attack in Tunisia, once the Arab Spring success story, now on the brink as the president tightens his grip on power. I ask Amnesty International whether democracy will survive. Plus,
there are very real issues within the church in almost every denomination or communion or setting right now.
Russell Moore, one of the biggest names in the evangelical movement, tells Michel Martin why he resigned from the Southern Baptist Convention. And we get the latest from the Tokyo Olympics as the greatest gymnast of all time, America's Simone Biles, withdraws.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Excruciating testimony on Capitol Hill today as four police officers recounted what it was like to fight the Capitol rioters on January 6th. It was the first public hearing into that insurrection, and here is some of their firsthand accounts.
The rioters call me traitor, a disgrace, and shouted that I, an army veteran and a police officer should be executed.
At one point, I came face to face with an attacker who repeatedly lunged for me and attempted to remove my firearm. I heard chanting from some in the crowd, "Get his gun and kill him with his own gun."
Terrorists pushed through the line and engaged us in hand-to-hand combat. Several attempted to knock me over and steal my baton. One latched onto my face and got his thumb in my right eye, attempting to gouge it out.
No one had ever, ever called me a while wearing the uniform of a Capitol Police officer.
It is hard to hear, harder to accept. Five people died that day and over 100 officers were injured. But incredibly, despite this attack on the nation and its values, Republicans have gone out of their way to downplay and try to obstruct this inquiry. Still, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has managed to gather a bipartisan committee, although she blocked two Republican members who had openly opposed the whole process, one of whom might be an actual material witness to former President Trump's involvement in that insurrection. Congressman Adam Kinzinger, one of two Republicans serving on this panel, could not hold back his tears when he thanked the officers for their service.
You know, you talk about the impact of that day, but you guys won. You guys helped. You know, democracies are not defined by our bad days. We're defined by how we come back from bad days.
Reliving what happened that day, what it means for the future. Joining me now to discuss this is the former Republican governor of New Jersey and the former 9/11 commission chair, Tom Kaine. Governor Kaine, welcome to the program. I really think you're the perfect guest because you had an independent bipartisan commission for 9/11. And now we have this sort of hybrid for January 6th. Do you believe after this opening day that it is something that's going to get to the truth and make a difference for the future?
It's going to be very helpful because we're going to find out things we don't know already on this terrible day. But it's hard because it is not bipartisan, as it should be. Whether or not the American people will therefore accept its findings or whether people will fight over those findings, we still have to see. But at least we're having some sort of investigation. It is something that simply has to be investigated if we're going to go on as a future of this democracy.
Okay, so it's important. I want to drill down on that before getting to the specifics, the very dramatic specifics of what transpired today. You know, you say we'll have to see whether the American people accept it. Describe your commission and what, briefly if you could, and what you think was the reason for which it was accepted, and in fact, Congress did act on your recommendations?
Well, we were authorized first by the United States Congress and then by the president. The members were appointed by both parties in both houses, and I was as chairman, I was appointed by the president. And as we, and then we did, I did something else, which turned out to be very important. When I was named chairman, and I met the vice chairman for the first time, Lee Hamilton, who was a very respected member of Congress for years, I said, Lee, I'm going to do nothing in this commission without your approval. Now, in Congress, the chairman is everything. The vice chairman is nothing. So Lee was taken back by that. And when the Democrats heard that I was going to do nothing as chairman without the approval of the vice chairman, the Democrat, things got a lot easier. And we did things together. All through the process, everything we did was bipartisan, and except as bipartisan. And therefore, neither side was able to criticize it. That was very, very important. Unfortunately, this is not set up that way. Republicans don't have any veto power. It's going to be run by the Democrats and hopefully run well by the Democrats. But it's more difficult to have it accepted. It's more difficult to find the truth, first of all. Secondly, more difficult to have it accepted by the American people if it is not outwardly bipartisan.
So let me ask you, you know, it was very dramatic, the testimony from these four police officers. And the Republican Party has traditionally stood for law and order. And, you know, they're constantly paying lip service to the value of the, you know, uniformed military and the police and this and that. But it appears that this time, you know, they didn't want to necessarily be part of this process. They blocked a lot of it. Let me ask you what you made of, for instance, one of the officers who more than a dozen times described the insurrectionists as terrorists. Another officer who talked about, you know, racial abuse that he had suffered and talked about how he believed that this wasn't just a spontaneous insurrection or whatever. It was something that was planned. First, the use of the word terrorists by one of the officers.
Yeah, well, it is terrorism. If you attack the United States Capitol for the first time since, I guess, the War of 1812, and do it with your own citizens, that's terrorism. So I'd accept that totally. And we've got to move on from here and find out the facts. Was it a conspiracy? Did people get ahead of time decide to do it together? Was it an attempt to invade the Capitol, or even more, to disrupt the process of certifying the election? Or was it something people got very emotional, thought the election was being taken away from them, and all of a sudden responded to the words of the president in a way that was irrational? This hearing has got to tell us the answer to those questions. And if in fact it was a planned conspiracy, then we've got to find a lot more about it and make sure that that never, ever, ever happens again.
Governor, so far the Justice Department has charged hundreds of people. I think today we've heard that there are hundreds more charges that have been laid down. And one of the officers, and his name, of course, is Harry Dunn, today hinted or said outright that he got early indications of this being more planned than spontaneous. Let's just play this this bit of his testimony.
But around 10:56 a.m., I received a text message from a friend forwarding a screenshot of what appeared to be the potential plan of action, very different from a peaceful demonstration. The screenshot bore the caption, January 6th, Rally Point, Lincoln Park, and said the objective was the Capitol. It said, amongst other things, that Trump has given us marching orders and to keep your guns hidden.
That's pretty dramatic. How do you react to that firsthand testimony from a Capitol Police officer?
Well, it's enormously dramatic. And who funded it? I mean, if these people were planned and came together to actually disrupt the United States government, who planned the disruption? And was it to stop the certifying of the election? Did they feel somehow that the election could be stopped at that point? It's crazy to think that anybody thought that, but maybe they did. A lot of crazy people involved in this thing. You know, this is why we have to have the facts. This is why we've got to not only get the facts, but hopefully we can have more and more people in a bipartisan sense come and accept the facts, and so we can move on.
Mm-hmm. So let me play a pretty strong piece of testimony by Officer Fanone, who's spoken quite a lot in public, and he's described, you know, the process and the fact that they have consistently been vilified by Trump supporters, by members of Congress who disagree with what happened on January 6th. This was what he said in his opening testimony today.
What makes the struggle harder and more painful is to know so many of my fellow citizens, including so many of the people I put my life at risk to defend, are downplaying or outright denying what happened. I feel like I went to hell and back to protect them and the people in this room. But too many are now telling me that hell doesn't exist, or that hell actually wasn't that bad. The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful.
Governor, I'm just going to ask you as a Republican, I mean, do you sympathize with him? And what do you feel about your party and those who have consistently played this thing down and have done what Fanone says is disgraceful?
Well, unfortunately, these days in Washington, politics seems to invade everything, even the most serious things like this invasion of the Capitol. And somehow we got to get each other back on board. This is to the country's best interests, Republicans and Democrats, to find out what happened here, how it happened, who was involved, who, if anybody, funded it. Was it a conspiracy? Wasn't it a conspiracy? Those are essential questions for this democracy, not for Republicans or Democrats, for democracy. And in order to find the answers to those questions, everybody should get on board. Now, unfortunately, it's off to a rocky start because of the fact it's not a bipartisan committee, and it is a committee in which one party has overwhelming dominance. That's too bad, but we've got to still got to take what we can get out of these hearings, what we can get out of this committee, and hopefully bring everybody on board, provided the committee is run as it should be run, and I hope it will be, to get the facts without caring whether it's Republican facts or Democratic facts, facts for the country.
Mm-hmm. The problem is, of course, there isn't both-siderism. Both sides are not, you know, are not equal in this case. There's an actual violent insurrection by one group of people against a legitimate constitutional process. And I just wonder what you think, because, or what the Republican Party thinks, because 58% of the American people support this congressional investigation. Obviously, it, you know, it breaks down along party lines, so it's not that, you know, it's not that surprising that most of those who support it are Democrats. But one of the things that you had going for you, and I've heard you speak about it, is that you were not in power. Those who were chairing and managing the 9/11 Commission were not actual sitting politicians, whereas in this case, they are. And it was the Republican Party who voted against an independent commission in this case. What are the pitfalls and the perils of not having, you know, outside politicians or officials managing this process?
Well, I had a conversation with the speaker about this early on, and I recommended strongly that it be done that way again, because we had nobody who was going to run for office again, nobody who was in office right then, nobody who had any stake in how it came out politically, even though there was a presidential election at that point right around the corner. Nobody had a stake in it. Everybody came out of a tradition of trying to help the democracy. And I think it's a lot easier to do it in the case with so much emotion involved with citizens who are not currently involved in the political system. But we're not there, unfortunately. We were unable to do that for whatever reason. And so I think we're stuck with this committee. Hopefully this committee will conduct itself honorably. Hopefully they'll take into consideration what people in both parties on the committee have to say. And hopefully it'll be a unanimous report that the American people can accept and move on from.
And finally, Governor, I just want to broaden it out slightly as a final question. Again, as a former Republican governor, I wonder what you make of this unbelievable weaponization of facts and the truth, not just in this instance, which is a complete attack on your democracy, which we all around the world are frankly perturbed by and are watching to see how it pans out, but also in terms of COVID. I mean, you've got a corruption of the truth that is killing people, and that you have Republican officials still unable to get themselves together to say, have your vaccines and protect yourself and protect the nation. This goes even beyond the Capitol in terms of protecting the United States, Governor, right?
Yes. I think, by the way, that's less and less true. I think more and more people are coming around and saying everybody ought to have the vaccine. And it's not only hurting yourself, it's hurting your neighbor and your friends and everybody else if you don't. So I think that's changing and changing in the right direction. But we're in a point in the democracy here where we're not talking to each other properly. We're not relying on facts. We don't have a relied on news source we'll agree with. And all of that is putting this democracy in greater and greater jeopardy. And so somehow we've got to get back. We've got to get back to the facts. We've got to get back to people we trust and trusting each other and working together in a way that we used to work together in this democracy, so that the country always came above party and the conscience always came above everything else. Mm. Somehow we got to get back to that.
Governor Kaine, thank you so much for your wisdom and your perspective today. Thanks a lot. So while we have seen that American democracy has been and perhaps remains in jeopardy, the State Department is also underscoring exactly how important it finds the fact of democracy abroad. In Tunisia, after months of quarreling over the dire economic situation and the handling of COVID, the country's president has sacked the government now. There were celebrations in the street, but others say it's a coup. A curfew is now in place and public gatherings are banned. 10 years ago, Tunisia was the first to demand democracy in what became the Arab Spring. And so what has gone wrong? Correspondent Ben Wiedemann charts Tunisia's fragile journey.
10 years ago, it was the first Arab country to topple its aging dictator, Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, in what became known as the Arab Spring, which brought down autocrats also in Egypt, Yemen, and Libya, and drew Libya and Syria each into a decade of war. In Tunisia, hopes were high that an era of democracy was finally dawning. And democracy did dawn, messy, chaotic, and divisive. What didn't come with democracy was prosperity. Saddled with debt left behind by the dictatorship, the economy stagnated, made worse by one of Africa's severest COVID outbreaks. Qais Said, a law professor and political independent, came to power in a landslide election 2 years ago. But since then, he clashed with the prime minister, now sacked, and with parliament. The Arab Spring began in Tunisia, and perhaps there it will end. Liberty and freedom are wonderful, but you can't eat democracy.
Ben Wiedemann there. Joining me now from Tunis to discuss all of this is Amna Gwilali. She is the Deputy Director for the Middle East and North Africa at Amnesty International. Amna, welcome to the program. Can I ask you, since you're sitting there in Tunis and probably also mindful of what's happening on your streets, as well as the reckoning happening in the United States, how significant is the turmoil where you are and perhaps the risk to democracy right now?
First of all, thanks for having me on the show. I think you explained quite well the context in the video that you showed. Tunisia has been undergoing a democratic process for 10 years now, since it toppled its longtime dictator, President Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, in 2011. And there were many achievements realized since then, with free and fair elections, a new democratic constitution, and a new system of governance. However, there was also a lot of disenchantment and discontent with the mismanagement of the country, with the lack of jobs, the dire economic situation, and most recently, the mishandling of the health crisis due to the COVID-19. And so popular demands were mounting to dismantle the parliament and to put a halt to the democratic process. And these demands met also with President Saied's own criticism of the constitutional process and his vision of a new democratic system that is more direct and based on local elections. And so it wasn't that much surprise to see that people were cheering at the streets. Now, what is important to note is that the democratic process in Tunisia, no matter how dysfunctional, ineffective, and flawed it was, did keep the country as a role model for democracy in a region which was plagued by wars and dictatorships, did prevent also a descent into a civil war and created a new system of governance where there were checks and balances.
You've raised some really important points. So yes, that's why we're looking at Tunisia, because exactly as you described, it was the great hope of your region. And now, whatever the President Saied says and wants, he has done, is consolidated power under his auspices, instituted a curfew, suspended parliament, fired the government. Do you believe that there is a way out of this towards re-establishing democracy? Or is this going to be a consolidation of power and a, let's say Egypt, when General Sisi cracked down and now has basically presides over one of the most authoritarian regimes in Egypt's history?
Well, the Egyptian model is definitely haunting many of the observers in Tunisia, but I think it is too early to make pronouncements on whether this is putting a halt to the democratic process as such and in an indefinite way, or whether we can reestablish democracy. What President Saied did so far is announce the suspension of the parliament for 30 days. It's a temporary period, but it is unknown whether he will really stick to that time frame or whether he will renew and prolong these exceptional measures. It is also very unclear whether he will consolidate his power on state institutions and concentrate the powers, which is a very high risk in Tunisia, given the past dictatorship and given the country, the regional also context, or whether he will conduct agreements and discussions with civil society, with political parties, to have a roadmap. What is clear for now is that there is a discrepancy between his discourse about his willingness to return to the democratic institutions and to not to derail democracy, and the lack of transparent, clear roadmap for a way out of this situation, which he says is temporary but can linger on, as we know. So, and there are other signs that are worrying. For example, the police forces moved to close down Al Jazeera premises in Tunis, which is really a backsliding on freedom of expression. There are also all kinds of other signs that are worrying and put the gains and achievements of the revolution in terms of human rights at risk, because there are no checks and balances. He has all the powers, and there is no one to stop him, basically.
Right. And of course, the minute you start cracking down on the free press, it sets a very, very chilling precedent and a chain of events in motion. I just want to play for you what President Saied described what he was doing. He said it last night in response to your main opposition group, or the main political party in Tunisia, Ennahda, calling it a coup. This is what the president has said.
Today, I have taken the responsibility. I am taking a historical responsibility. Those who claim that this matter is related to a coup need to revise your constitutional lessons.
So, are you sensing any possibility that it could develop into, I don't know, military on the street, a military crackdown? As you know, the United States has expressed concern. They will not call it a coup. That they say it has all sorts of legal connotations. What should the U.S. be doing, your partners or Tunisia's partners in the outer world?
I think, first of all, on the determination of whether it is a coup or not, there are many interpretations, and definitely Saeed tried to ground it into the constitutional and legal framework, but he overstepped his power nonetheless, because the constitution does not grant him the right to suspend the parliament. And so I think it is very important to be monitoring the situation. Right now, it is too early to say whether it will go into a military rule or not. The next days will be really crucial to assess what is the direction that the president is taking. So if there are, for example, arbitrary arrests of political figures, purges of the political elite, if there are unfair trials or military trials, etc., that will be a very important sign that we are on the road to dictatorship. And I believe that international partners of Tunisia should be much more alarmed than what they have expressed right now in terms of their reaction to the situation.
Yeah, thank you, Amna Gwelali. It's really important because, as we've said over and again, Tunisia is the bellwether of democracy and you know, reform in your part of the world. So thank you. Turning now to perhaps the biggest upset yet at the 2020 Olympics, the world's greatest gymnast, the U.S., Simone Biles, has pulled out of the team final in Tokyo. The four-time Olympic gold medalist said that she has to focus on her mental health. Take a listen.
I just felt like it would be a little bit better to take a back seat, work on my mindfulness, and I knew that the girls would do an absolutely great job, and I didn't want to risk the team a medal for kind of my screw-ups, because they've worked way too hard for that.
Well, the girls, as she said, did in fact snag a silver medal. Our next guest knows Simone Biles very well. She is her former teammate, Ali Raisman, the six-time Olympic medalist and former USA gymnastics captain. And she is joining me now. Welcome, Ali Raisman, to the program. Let me just first ask you your reaction to what we heard Simone Biles just say about mental health and mindfulness, and the fact that, you know, she wasn't there with the team when they contested the event today.
So Simone actually was there. She performed on vault, and then she stayed there for the rest of the competition to cheer on her teammates. I'm absolutely devastated for Simone. I feel so bad for her. I feel sick to my stomach. I just am praying that she's okay. I'm praying that she gets the support and the love that she needs. I know how much all of the girls have worked so hard for this moment, and I think that they did an incredible job. It's not easy to perform in an Olympic team final under such immense pressure, and I'm so proud of them for winning the silver medal.
Have you actually spoken to Simone?
No, I have not. I have reached out to her, but I can't imagine what Simone is going through. I honestly can't even imagine. I know how much Simone has dreamt of this moment, how hard she's been working. And so it's I can't imagine. And as I said, just sending her all the love and support. And I hope that she's getting the support that she needs.
I hope so, too, of course. And so does all the world and all her fans. Let me just play a little bit, as you rightly say, she did take part in some of it. She talked about her performance on the vault and how it sort of cemented her decision. Let's just play this little bit.
I was trying a 2.5, and I ended up doing a 1.5, just got a little bit lost in the air, which is really unfortunate, especially to have a score like that go up there for the team. I feel like I robbed them of a couple of tens, and we could have been a little bit higher in the rankings. But, I was trying a 2.5, ended up doing a 1.5, which was definitely not my best work.
Okay, so Ali Raisman, it's really interesting to hear somebody who's been called the greatest gymnast of all times talk about how she couldn't actually perform what she was trying to perform. Tell us how that happens for somebody of that experience at that level, you know, under that, I guess, that pressure, but somebody who's trained and trained for that.
Yeah, well, you know, I also just want to remind people that Simone Biles is human, and every single athlete, no matter how successful they are, every single athlete has good days and bad days, and every athlete has performances that they look back, they wish they did better. But to be honest, getting lost in the air, which is, you know, as Simone said, she was going for a 2.5 twist and ended up doing a 1.5 twist. That's actually very common for some gymnasts, and it would happen to me sometimes in my gymnastics career. It's just unfortunate that it did happen in the team final at the Olympic Games. But, you know, it could have been anything. I'm curious, whenever Simone is ready to share, if she can think about why she got lost. Sometimes there's no reason behind it. Sometimes you just get a little bit confused in the air. I think gymnastics is one of those sports where, you know, someone like Simone makes it look easy, but it's actually, in fact, very difficult. And so when you think about what she's actually doing, a 2.5 twist, sometimes what happens is you're in the air and you kind of lose track of, have I done a half twist? Have I done two twists? It gets a little bit confusing. So it is, in fact, actually very common. It's just, you know, I think it just shows, unfortunately, that even the best athletes in the world, they have good days and bad days. And I commend her for her bravery and speaking up and doing what was right for her and what she felt was right for the team. It's not easy. But, you know, even the greatest athletes of all time, they're not perfect and they're human, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I want to get more to the human side in a second. But first, I just want to ask you to reflect again on the fact that her team did pull off a silver medal. And as far as I know, they are obviously not as experienced as her. I think a lot of them, if not all of them, are first-time Olympians. Correct me if I'm wrong. But they actually did, you know, do something amazing. Talk about what it must have been like for them.
Yeah, the whole team did an incredible job. And, you know, I think going into the Olympic Games and knowing you have a teammate like Simone Biles is always an extra confidence booster, because you know you can count on Simone's scores. And so what happens in the team final is it's three girls go up on each event and every single score counts. And so there's four girls on the team, so one girl is not performing on each event. And so, you know, for example, Jordan Chiles was not supposed to go up on bars and beam, and I'm not sure if Sunisa was supposed to go on floor. I don't think she was supposed to go last. So either way, they've been training for this 3-up, 3-count style, and so every single day in practice, they're all going in the same exact order, and the girls that were not thinking about actually performing on those events didn't even warm up in the morning, so they had to, like, mentally prepare themselves to go up on the events, which is not easy to do, especially in an Olympic team final. So there's already enough pressure, and then last minute, when you're not planning to go on bars or beam or floor and you have to go up, it takes a lot of mental strength to get yourself ready, especially when you weren't even able to warm up in the back gym. So they did a great job, and I also want to say Simone again was there cheering for them the whole time, which it's got to be so hard for her to watch them, and she did such a great job. So I'm proud of all of them, and I was also so impressed with their beam. The beam is 4 inches wide, so for them to go up and hit in the team final when they know that their best athlete is out, I think really speaks to the team and how mentally tough they were. So I'm very proud of them.
Can I ask you whether you have a gut feeling? She has said, and I guess the officials have said, that they'll assess it each day. And she's pulled out of the team event, but I believe there's some individual competition that she could take part in. Do you think she will?
You know, I don't know, and I personally haven't spoken to Simone yet since the competition. So I'm not sure. I think, you know, I like everyone else, I'm hoping that she's able to. But as Simone says, her mental health should be the priority. And it's the same with all the other athletes. I think it's really important we take a second and really think about how much pressure is on these Olympic athletes, and that the mental health of these athletes should be the priority. And I think we need to start questioning, what is there for these athletes in place? Like, is there someone that's able to help Simone in this moment that's actually in Tokyo? And if not, that needs to change for future generations. And so I hope so, but I honestly just don't know the answer, because I don't know what Simone is thinking. But I think it's really smart to take it day by day. And I'm hoping she gets a good night's sleep and wakes up tomorrow and feels good.
So on that point that you just made, is, I guess, U.S. gymnastics, do you feel that they're in a position to help more? What more could they do? And let's just not beat about the bush. You all had a pretty traumatic experience. You know, you talked about, you testified about the team doctor, Larry Nassar, who abused so many of you all for so long, and that you were not protected and your mental and physical health were not prioritized. You know, Naomi Osaka has come out in different ways, you know, expressing her mental fragility at this particular time, whether it was pulling out of Wimbledon, also now defeated in Tokyo. There's more willingness, I think, to talk about this. And as you say, take brave decisions. But the trauma is long lasting, and what you've all had to go through is still there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what we've all been through is so traumatic. And I think it's something that, you know, I can't speak for every survivor, obviously, but I just know from a lot of them are my friends. And I know from chatting with a good amount of them that we're still dealing with it every single day. And to be honest, you know, what Simone even went through today and what she's been going through the last few months, all of these Olympic athletes, I think there's also sort of this anxiety and this fear of disappointing people. And it's really overwhelming and it's really, really scary. I mean, I think being a part of the U.S. Olympic team, you know, we're lucky that we have so many incredible athletes, but there is so much pressure to win that gold medal. And it can be so consuming and kind of take over your life and almost it feels like it's hard to breathe sometimes. So I think that, you know, USA Gymnastics, the United States Olympic Committee really have to take a hard look at the way that they're treating their athletes. When I was competing, there was really no resources and mental health wasn't really a discussion. I'm not in Tokyo right now as an athlete, so I'm not sure what they have available now. I hope that there is people there that Simone feels safe going to that can support her and can get her the help if she wants it. But I definitely think that's something that it needs to be more of a conversation going forward, and there has to be programs in place to help athletes and also help athletes that didn't do as well as they wanted to and feel afraid that they're letting people down. There's mm-hmm. got to be someone there that can help support them through these hard times.
Ali Raisman, thank you so much indeed for joining us. Now we go to turmoil and leadership in the church. Theologian Russell Moore is one of the most influential figures in evangelical Christianity today. But back in May, he sent shockwaves through his community after resigning his leadership in the Southern Baptist Convention. A leaked letter alleging raw racist sentiment was one of many damning reasons he walked away. And here he is speaking to Michelle Martin.
Pastor Russell Moore, thank you so much for talking with us.
No, thanks for having me, Michelle.
Obviously, many people are familiar with your work, but for those who are not, I mean, you have been one of the most high-profile evangelical leaders in the country for many years now. For some people, you probably are the face of the evangelical movement. When did it start to go wrong for you? When did things internally start to chafe? When did you start to notice some sort of friction there?
Well, I don't think that things went wrong. I think in some ways things went very right in that I came to see new ways to equip Christians and God doing a new thing. And frankly, within the Southern Baptist Convention, the people in the Southern Baptist Convention were overwhelmingly not just supportive, but beyond supportive and loving and affirming. My board was as well. I think that what I was starting to see was the same thing that virtually, I mean, almost every pastor I'm talking to right now is seeing, which is a congregation where the vast majority of people really mm-hmm. want to love each other, really want to follow Christ. And sometimes there's a very small group within that congregation that doesn't want to. And that creates a different kind of temperature in the room. And so what a pastor has to decide is, do I continue working toward change in this congregation, which is usually the way to go, or in other ways to say, maybe I should be doing something different.
So why'd you resign?
Because I started to see God doing something new in terms of putting people together from multiple denominations who have the same concern. So I was having conversation every single day with Anglicans and Presbyterians and non-denominational people and others who were saying, it seems to me that we have a moment where we need to put the gospel first and we need to put the kingdom first. and we need each other to do that. And so Christianity Today, being the way that that the evangelical movement essentially launched in the post-war era, I think we have a very similar moment right now.
So you're focusing very much on what you're going toward, not what you're leaving. Mm-hmm. Perfectly understandable. But I have to say, your resignation letter landed like a rocket. It was leaked. I don't know who leaked it. I know that we've all read it. You've not denied that it is your words. It's blistering. It's absolutely blistering. You say that the presenting issue, you said, is not the former president. You say the presenting issue was the way the denomination itself or the leadership was dealing with sexual abuse, thing one. But you also say that you and your family face constant threats from white nationalists and white supremacists, including within the convention. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. Yes. Well, that wasn't a resignation letter. It was a letter that I had written to my board members. Just they pray with me, and I was helping them to see some of the things that were going on. Yes. I mean, I think that there are very real issues within the church in almost every denomination or communion or setting right now when it comes to these issues of racial justice and reconciliation and sexual abuse. I mean, I'm finding this as recently as just right before this this interview, talking to a pastor who's combating this within the congregation. And it can be exhausting. It can be demoralizing. But it also means that there's an opportunity for the people of God to do what's right.
I hear you, but it is disturbing. I mean, when did you start to see these things? I mean, has this been kind of a little hum all along, like sort of like the pilot light in your furnace that is always there? Or was this something that you became newly aware of because of the prominence of your position?
Well, I think that issues of racial justice particularly had always been disturbing to me. It was one of the reasons why I went through a spiritual crisis as a 15-year-old when I was looking at Bible Belt Christianity and seeing a lot of very blatant racism and wondering how can these two things go together? I mean, one cannot read the Bible and see the actions of Jesus and seeing the sort of church that Jesus puts together and come to this kind of conclusion that racism is anything other than morally wrong. And so that's been a concern for me for all of my life. I think there are many people who are rattled by some of the things that we're seeing in terms of sexual abuse and the treatment of sexual abuse survivors and cover-ups taking place. Again, not just in one setting and not just even within a church setting, but within multiple settings in the United States right now. But the church is called to better. And so we ought to be the place that is the toughest on sexual abuse and the place that is the most caring for survivors and victims of sexual abuse. I think that is something we must do better. I remember having a conversation with a group of evangelical women a couple of years ago, and one of the women there said, "It seems to me that when you're seeing some of these revelations that are taking place with some high profile scandals, some high profile cover-ups, it seems that you're rattled by that. And we want you to know that none of us are surprised by this." Mm-hmm. And the entire room full of women were nodding their heads. And that was really a key moment for me in seeing just how deep some of these problems go.
You said earlier that this is a minority of people within the convention, within the denomination, within the universe. And that, you know, sort of makes sense. I mean, Southern Baptists, at least to the current moment, have been the largest Protestant denomination. So we're talking about, you know, millions of people. On the other hand, the areas in which you have constantly faced criticism within your movement have been when you've surfaced these issues. I mean, when you have publicly called for more diversity in the leadership of the convention, you were criticized for that. When you have showcased women who have wanted to speak about their experiences with sexual misconduct, you were criticized for that. Mm-hmm. In fact, you say in your letter that from the very beginning of my service, I've been attacked with the most vicious guerrilla tactics on such matters and have been told to be quiet about this by others. You said that, you know, you've heard just the most vicious racist comments, like behind the scenes. So if that's the case, then how can you say, I mean, forgive me, that it's not somehow defining or pervasive within the movement? You see what I say? How can both of those things be true?
Well, I think both of those things can be true because if you look at what the denomination as a whole would do when they would come together in their annual meetings, they would not be in any way in the direction that you just mentioned. As a matter of fact, I was often surprised at just how strong the Southern Baptist Convention would end up being in their June meetings in terms of support for racial reconciliation and justice and standing up for sexual abuse survivors. That wasn't the problem. The problem was what was happening between meetings. And I found that that's the case in a number of institutions right now, where sometimes the people who are the most obsessed with the politics, the internal politics, tend to be the least healthy people, and vice versa.
What role do you think race plays in this? I mean, is it possible that race has become more important than the gospel? Is it possible?
In some sectors, I think it certainly has. And if this is not new, though. If you look back at the New Testament, you're going to find so much of it has to do with this very question, whether or not people are going to idolize the flesh and exercise dominion over one another, or whether or not people are going to be part of one body and one fellowship. This is a repeated issue in the New Testament, and it's been a repeated issue throughout history. So if you notice, even what we tend to think of as the contemporary evangelical movement happened in the 1940s and 50s with a diverging of those who wanted to be separatist fundamentalists and those who wanted to be gospel-focused, gospel-centered evangelicals. They were in many cases, they agreed on all the fundamentals of the faith, but they disagreed very much about the ways that culture can shift and can take any religion captive. I mean, that's really the issue.
You can't help but notice that, say, white evangelicals were among the former president's strongest constituencies. Yes. They are among the most hesitant right now to embrace public health measures to contain the coronavirus. And it's all the more noteworthy because these are folks who espouse an ethic of protecting the sanctity of life. And yet they have proven to be among the most unwilling to take measures to protect the sanctity of some lives, of vulnerable lives. And why is that? Why is that?
I don't know. I think we're in a moment of a kind of crisis of credibility. That's one of the things that I've been speaking to repeatedly. And frankly, what takes up most of my time and energy right now is talking to young evangelical Christians who are disillusioned and who are fighting against cynicism, usually not yielding to it, but fighting against it. And they have every reason to in many cases. So we really have a long project ahead of us of rebuilding evangelical credibility on the basis of being the people who are what we say we are and believe what we say we believe. I mean, this is one of the things that's interesting to me, is that when I find this sort of disillusionment taking place among younger Christians, it's usually not for the reasons that people assume, that they can't believe what the church teaches. It's instead just the opposite. They fear that the church doesn't believe what it teaches. So we need to be the people who are consistent, who are working to maintain integrity and consistency across the board. And that means loving our neighbor when it comes to public health measures and so forth. And what I would say is, what I find often with secular people is that they assume that the problem here is the pastoral leadership. And I have found that not to be the case. There are some high profile sort of pastors who or on television telling people not to be vaccinated or that the blood of Jesus will protect you from COVID and so forth. That's very rare, though, from what I'm finding on the ground. in most cases, pastors are leading kind of heroically in their communities, and not just with their own churches, but many of them are facing really significant backlash from, again, often small groups of people within congregations, but a small group of people can change the entire dynamic. So that's a challenge and a crisis for us right now.
Is the former president a symptom, or is he, forgive me, the disease? Was he the symptom, or was he the cause?
I think he was in some ways a symptom and in some ways a driver. And by driver, what I mean is sort of the mode of discourse that now seems normal to us, including in terms of church life. I don't think he created that, but I do think that the last 5 years have normalized that. So I'll often talk to pastors who will feel as though they're failures because they look at Facebook feeds of their members, and they see people using language and sarcasm and personal attack in ways that aren't consistent with the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes. And they say to themselves, where did I go wrong? We're living in a cultural ecosystem where things that would have been shocking to us just a few years ago have now become routine and have become normal. I think that that's a big, big part of this.
As we've discussed, the Southern Baptists have been the country's largest Protestant denomination. But as you know, the convention saw its largest single membership drop from 2018 to 2019. It's the 13th straight year of decline, as I understand it. Why do you think that is?
I think there are a number of reasons for that. And I think one of the reasons is, you know, somebody who's growing up at a time when I was is somebody who is really taught that one's denominational identity is one's identity almost, secondary to identity in Christ, but certainly present there in a way that's not the case now. So there will be people who will move from Presbyterian Church to Methodist Church to Baptist Church to Anglican Church with relative ease in a way that never would have happened before. Then you add to that some of the things that we've been talking about earlier with the sort of crisis of credibility and cynicism and the sort of despair that is coming toward institutions that sometimes people feel have failed them. And all of that adds up to the moment that we find ourselves in now.
Do you see your movement as being one that can recapture prominence? I don't know how else to describe it. Because one of the things that you wrote about in one of your earlier books, Onward, was engaging the culture without losing the gospel, was really about accepting, if I can put it as bluntly as possible, accepting the fact that some of the core principles that evangelicals adhere to are not shared by the broader society. They just aren't. It's just not the majority view. Mm-hmm. Some people see the way our politics is unfolding as a way for a minority of people to try to dominate the majority with their views. Do you think that's fair? And do you think that that's possible?
Well, I don't think that evangelical Christianity should be seeking to dominate anyone. The gospel does not come through coercion. It comes through persuasion and the power of the Holy Spirit. I think one of the problems is that sometimes there's a tendency to try to find a golden age in the past where evangelical Christianity was dominant and prominent. And that's not what I think we need to be looking to. Instead, I think we need to be looking to following Christ, which means having confidence in the gospel such that we don't believe that we need to seek prominence or to coerce people or to be some sort of a political movement at the table, but instead be the sort of people who can bear witness to the grace of Jesus Christ and then to embody that and to show that.
What does that look like?
Well, I think it looks like churches that hold to their convictions and love one another and are able to deal with kindness toward those who don't understand them and who don't get them. And I think you see that in communities all over, not just all over North America, but all over the world right now, with Christians who genuinely see the people around them who disagree with them, not as people to be attacked or in some sort of war with, but as people to love and to serve. And we can talk honestly about where we have disagreements, but do so trying to persuade each other, not trying to shut one another down.
Russell Moore, Pastor Russell Moore, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And that's it for now. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.